This CLE is based on New York State appellate decisions released in June 2020 dealing with issues relating to negligence. Selected decisions were summarized. The summaries were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in June 2020, and those summaries have subsequently been collected into an organized pamphlet. It is that June 2020 negligence update pamphlet that constitutes the written materials for this CLE course, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The pamphlet is available through a link on the podcast page, the June 2020 negligence update podcast page. The first case is on pages 4 and 5, Creative Restaurant Incorporated. It's an architectural malpractice case, and it involves the statute of limitations as it relates to the continuous representation doctrine. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the complaint alleging architectural malpractice should not have been dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3211. Plaintiff leased the first floor of a building to operate a pizza restaurant. Plaintiff hired a contractor, which in turn hired an architect for the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning design. The gas line hookup was completed in 2014. Subsequently, in 2016, National Grid shut off the gas, alleging plaintiff was stealing gas. In 2017, the defendant architect allegedly attempted to remedy the problem with the gas line. The complaint adequately pled the statute of limitations was told by the continuous representation doctrine and a privity-like relationship between the plaintiff and the architect. The court wrote, "The law recognizes that the supposed completion of the contemplated work does not preclude application of the continuous representation toll if inadequacies or other problems with the contemplated work timely manifest themselves after that date, and the parties continue the professional relationship to remedy those problems." In support of its motion, the architect submitted documentary evidence, which included the final invoice issued by it, dated August 14, 2014, and a letter of completion issued by the New York City Department of Buildings to the architect stating that its work was completed on December 20, 2014. In opposition, the plaintiff's submissions, which included evidence of continuing communications between plaintiff and the architect, and evidence of the architect's efforts to remedy the alleged error uncovered by National Grid regarding the gas line connection for the premises, raised a question of fact as to the application of the continuous representation doctrine and supported the denial of those branches of the architect's motion, which were pursuant to CPLR 3211, to dismiss the amended complaint insofar as asserted against it. Contrary to the architect's contention, the fact that 2 years had elapsed between the completion of its services and its subsequent efforts to remedy the problem does not render the continuous representation doctrine inapplicable as a matter of law. We also reject the architect's contention as an alternative ground that dismissal of the amended complaint insofar as asserted against it was warranted pursuant to CPLR 3211 on the ground that it was not in privity with the plaintiffs. The evidence submitted by the architect, which included a copy of the contract entered into between it and the contractor, failed to utterly refute the factual allegations supporting the plaintiff's contention that a relationship existed between them and the architect that was the functional equivalent of privity. Next is Kiernan versus Arevalo Valencia. It's on page 5. It's a medical malpractice case, and it involves the sufficiency of an expert affidavit. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's expert's affirmation raised a question of fact in this failure to diagnose medical malpractice case, even though the affirmation dealt with an area of medicine outside of the expert's area of practice, which was general surgery. The court wrote, "The plaintiff's expert's affirmation was not lacking in probative value because the plaintiff's expert was board certified in general surgery rather than internal medicine. A medical expert need not be a specialist in a particular field in order to testify regarding accepted practices in that field. However, the expert must be possessed of the requisite skill, training, education, knowledge, or experience from which it can be assumed that the opinion rendered is reliable. Thus, where a physician opines outside his or her area of specialization, a foundation must be laid tending to support the reliability of the opinion rendered. Where no such foundation is laid, the expert's opinion is of no probative value. Here, the plaintiff's expert's affirmation sufficiently established that the plaintiff's expert was possessed of the requisite skill, training, education, knowledge, and experience from which it can be assumed that the opinion rendered was reliable. In particular, the expert demonstrated that he was qualified to render an opinion regarding the symptomology of temporal arteritis, which he characterized as a relatively common disease of the arteries, and as to whether a proper examination and investigation of the symptoms was conducted in accordance with accepted medical practices. Next is matter of Atkinson versus New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, which is a municipal corporation requiring a notice of claim. It's a medical malpractice case. The first department, reversing Supreme Court, held leave to file a late notice of claim should not have been granted in this action against the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, alleging a failure to timely diagnose breast cancer. The medical records did not alert the Health and Hospitals Corporation to injury from malpractice, and petitioner failed to show that the Health and Hospitals Corporation was not prejudiced by the delay in serving a notice of claim. The court wrote, petitioner failed to show that the Health and Hospitals Corporation had actual notice of her claim within 90 days of accrual of the complaint, or a reasonable time thereafter. Health and Hospital Corporation's mere possession or creation of medical records does not ipso facto establish that it had actual knowledge of a potential injury where the records do not evince that the medical staff, by its acts or omissions, inflicted any injury on the plaintiff. Here, the Health and Hospitals Corporation records of petitioner's treatment do not on their face show any negligence, malpractice, or injury to plaintiff, and plaintiff did not submit a physician's affirmation to make such a showing. Likewise, petitioner failed to demonstrate the lack of any prejudice to Health and Hospitals Corporation from the delay, as Health and Hospitals Corporation's possession of medical records that could not alert it to a claim of malpractice obviously cannot ipso facto establish a lack of prejudice. Because petitioner offered no other basis for the lack of prejudice to Health and Hospitals Corporation, the burden never shifted to Health and Hospitals Corporation to show prejudice from the delay. Next is matter of Dush versus Erie County Medical Center. It's another medical malpractice action against a municipal corporation, again requiring a notice of claim. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court over a two-justice dissent, held claimant's application for leave to file a late notice of claim in this medical malpractice action should have been granted. The court noted that the medical records submitted for the first time in a reply were properly considered because the respondents addressed the relevant issues at oral argument. Both the majority and the dissent noted that the excuse for failure to timely file the notice of claim was inadequate, but that defect did not require denial of the application. The majority found claimant demonstrated respondents were not prejudiced by the delay. The dissent disagreed with the majority's finding that the medical records demonstrated respondents had timely notice of the nature of the claim. The court wrote, we reject the contention of respondents and the dissent that it is inappropriate under the circumstances of this case to consider the medical records submitted by claimant for the first time in his reply papers. In general, the function of reply papers is to address arguments made in opposition to the position taken by the move-ant and not to permit the move-ant to introduce new arguments in support of or new grounds or evidence for the motion or application. This rule, however, is not inflexible, and a court, in the exercise of its discretion, may consider a claim or evidence offered for the first time in reply where the offering party's adversaries responded to the newly presented evidence or claim. The medical records evince that respondent's medical staff, by its acts or omissions, inflicted an injury on claimant. The medical records indicate that following the surgical skin graft procedure, claimant developed swelling beneath the dressings that became constrictive of blood flow to the leg and ultimately caused necrosis, and that respondent's medical staff, for various reasons, had failed to recognize the ischemic nature of the leg and claimant's development of compartment syndrome, thereby eventually necessitating partial amputation of the leg. We thus conclude that respondent's timely acquired actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting the claim. Next is the Galue case, G-A-L-U-E, page 8. It deals with res ipsa loquitur and a municipal law issue, New York City Administrative Code issue. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court and ordering a new trial, held that the jury should have been instructed on the res ipsa loquitur doctrine and the violation of the New York City Administrative Code was some evidence of negligence. Plaintiff was allegedly injured when a towel dispenser slash trash receptacle fell out of the wall. The court wrote, "We find that the trial court improvidently exercised its discretion in declining to charge the jury on res ipsa loquitur. A res ipsa charge merely permits the jury to infer negligence from the circumstances of the occurrence. The doctrine does not require sole physical access to the instrumentality causing the injury. The trial court should also have charged that a violation of Administrative Code of the City of New York, Section 28-301.1, which requires property owners to maintain their buildings in a safe condition, constitutes some evidence of negligence. To the extent that the towel dispenser unit allegedly fell out of the wall 8 months after installation by the defendant, John Spaccarelli, the court erred by failing to allow plaintiff to fully question the credentials of Mr. Spaccarelli and his qualifications as an expert." So again, a new trial was ordered there, fundamentally because the res ipsa loquitur doctrine was not charged to the jury. Next is Canty versus City of New York on page 9. It's another res ipsa loquitur case. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held summary judgment should not have been granted pursuant to the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur. Plaintiff was injured when a light fixture fell on him. The pipe to which the fixture was attached was bent and was preserved by the defendant. The light fixture, which was the same as several others at the site, was not preserved. Because contractors were working at the site and the pipe securing the light fixture was bent, it could not be said defendant exercised exclusive control over the fixture. The Second Department went on to find that sanctions for the loss of the light fixture were not warranted because the bent pipe was saved and the light fixture itself was not crucial evidence. The court wrote, "Res ipsa loquitur is a doctrine which is submitted to the finder of fact when the accident arises out of an event which ordinarily does not occur in the absence of negligence. The accident was caused by an agency or instrumentality within the exclusive control of the defendant, and it was not due to a voluntary action or contribution on the part of the plaintiff." The Court of Appeals has held that only in the rarest of res ipsa loquitur cases may a plaintiff win summary judgment or a directed verdict. That would happen only when the plaintiff's circumstantial proof is so convincing and the defendant's response so weak that the inference of defendant's negligence is inescapable. So in this case, Supreme Court should not have granted plaintiff's motion for summary judgment pursuant to the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur. Next is Mallett versus City of New York on page 10. It's a slip and fall case involving an out of possession landlord. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant out of possession landlord's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should have been granted. Plaintiff allegedly slipped on ice which formed from a leak in a pipe in a walk-in freezer. The lease did not require the landlord to maintain the freezer, and no statutory violation was alleged. The court wrote, An out-of-possession landlord is not liable for injuries that occur on its premises unless the landlord has retained control over the premises and has a duty imposed by statute or assumed by contract or course of conduct. Here, where the complaint sounds in common law negligence and the plaintiff does not allege the violation of a statute, the defendants demonstrated their prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by establishing that they were out of possession, that they were an out-of-possession landlord that was not bound by contract or course of conduct to repair the allegedly dangerous condition. The lease in this case specified that the landlord's obligations do not include the performance nor the payment of the costs for the maintenance, repair, and or replacement of the freezer system or the replacement of the refrigeration system at any time. Next is Nigro versus Village of Mamaroneck. It's on pages 10 and 11. It's a slip and fall case, and it involves a municipal law sidewalk. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the village's motion for summary judgment in this sidewalk slash tree well slip and fall case should not have been granted. The village demonstrated it did not have the required written notice of the defect, but did not demonstrate it didn't create the defect. The court wrote, a municipality that has adopted a prior written notice law cannot be held liable for a defect within the scope of the law absent the requisite written notice, unless an exception to the requirement applies. Two exceptions to the prior written notice requirement have been recognized, namely, where the locality created the defect or hazard through an affirmative act of negligence, and where a specific use confers a special benefit upon the locality. The prima facie showing which a defendant must make on a motion for summary judgment is governed by the allegations of liability made by the plaintiff in the pleadings. Here, the plaintiff alleged in her complaint and bill of particulars that the village affirmatively created the defect that caused the accident. Therefore, in order to establish its prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, the village had to demonstrate both that it did not have prior written notice of the defect and that it did not create the defect. The village established prima facie that it did not have prior written notice of the defect, but it failed to establish prima facie that it did not affirmatively create the alleged defect. So the village's motion for summary judgment in that case should not have been granted. Next is Harrison versus City of New York. It's another sidewalk slip and fall. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether the sidewalk defect, which allegedly caused plaintiff to fall, was depicted on the Big Apple map. Therefore, the question whether the city had written notice of the defect was for the jury. The court wrote, Administrative Code of the City of New York, Section 7-201, Subdivision C2, limits the city's duty of care over municipal streets and sidewalks by imposing liability only for those defects or hazardous conditions which its officials have been actually notified exist at a specific location. Accordingly, prior written notice of a defect is a condition precedent which plaintiff is required to plead and prove to maintain an action against the city. Big Apple is a corporation established by the New York State Trial Lawyers Association for the purpose of giving notices in compliance with Administrative Code of the City of New York, Section 7-201. It does so through maps on which coded symbols are entered to represent defects. A Big Apple map submitted to the Department of Transportation may serve as prior written notice of a defective condition. Whereas here, there are factual disputes regarding the precise location of the defect that allegedly caused the plaintiff's fall, and whether the alleged defect is designated on the Big Apple map, the question should be resolved by a jury. So the question whether the defect appears on the Big Apple map is now a jury question in that case. Next is the Modugno case. It's M-O-D-U-G-N-O, Modugno, on pages 12 and 13. Another slip and fall case. Second Department held that the Labor Law 200 and Common Law negligence causes of action properly survived summary judgment. Plaintiff was working in the bottom of a hole, which was muddy from heavy rain and littered with boulders and rocks. Plaintiff was injured when he allegedly slipped and fell because of the mud. The second department held that the causes of action were based upon a dangerous condition, not the method and manner of work, and the appellants did not demonstrate they lacked actual or constructive notice of the mud and rock condition. The court wrote, Labor Law Section 200 is a codification of the common law duty imposed on owners, contractors, and their agents to provide workers with a safe place to work. There are two broad categories of actions that implicate the provisions of Labor Law Section 200. The first category involves worker injuries arising out of alleged dangerous or defective conditions on the premises where the work is performed. In those circumstances, for liability to be imposed on the property owner, there must be evidence showing that the property owner either created a dangerous or defective condition or had actual or constructive notice of it without remedying it within a reasonable time. The second category of actions under Labor Law Section 200 involves injuries arising from the method and manner of work. A property owner will be held liable under this category only if it possessed the authority to supervise or control the means and methods of work. Contrary to the appellant's contention, the plaintiff's accident arose from a dangerous premises condition, not from the method and manner of the work. Where a plaintiff alleges that he or she was injured at a work site as a result of a dangerous premises condition, a property owner's liability under Labor Law Section 200 and for common law negligence rests upon whether the property owner created the condition or had actual or constructive notice of it and a reasonable amount of time within which to correct the condition. So here again, the denial of the defendant's motion for summary judgment was affirmed. Next is Langer versus MTA Capital Construction Company. It's here as an example of a very rare situation where summary judgment is appropriate in a negligence action. First Department held that this was a rare case where summary judgment was appropriate on a Labor Law 200 common law negligence cause of action. The court wrote, here PSJV, that was the entity responsible for cleaning up the site, at a time when the project was open to the elements, covered a recessed area of the third floor where rainwater regularly collected with non-waterproof planking and never inspected it for water accumulation. PSJV did not warn plaintiff or his employer that he was working under the recessed area, and when he drilled into the second floor ceiling to affix electrical equipment, the sludgy, oily water poured down onto him, causing him to lose his balance and injure himself. Plaintiffs made a prima facie showing that the accident occurred due to a defective condition on the premises of which PSJV had actual notice, having caused and created it. In response, PSJV failed to adduce credible evidence that anyone else, including plaintiff electrician, negligently caused the accident. So again, the party which created the dangerous condition did not survive a motion for summary judgment by the plaintiff in that case. Next is Fisher versus American Built Right on pages 13 and 14. It's a toxic torts case involving asbestos. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant's motion for summary judgment in this asbestos injury case should not have been granted, and alternatively, even if the motion were properly granted, leave to renew should have been granted based on additional evidence. So again, the defendant's motion for summary judgment in this asbestos injury case should not have been granted. The court wrote, in connection with a motion for summary judgment in an action based on exposure to asbestos, defendant has the initial burden of showing unequivocally that its product could not have contributed to the causation of decedent's asbestos-related injury. Defendant Burnham failed to sustain its initial burden of demonstrating that its products could not have contributed to decedent's mesothelioma. Decedent's testimony identified defendant as the manufacturer of greenhouses in which he worked and cited three possible sources of asbestos: transite benches in the greenhouses, window glazing, and the greenhouse boiler. Burnham provided no evidence demonstrating that its products could not have been the source of the asbestos that caused the decedent's illness. It only pointed to gaps in plaintiff's proof, which was insufficient to meet its burden. Even if the burden had shifted, plaintiff's evidence in opposition raised an issue of fact as to whether Burnham had sold, distributed, and recommended asbestos-containing products such as those used in plaintiff's family gardening business. While hearsay, that evidence could be considered by the court since it was not the sole basis of the opposition to the summary judgment motion. Alternatively, even if the summary judgment motion had been properly granted, the court should have granted leave to renew in the interests of fairness and justice, since plaintiffs presented an affidavit of decedent's estranged brother, which supplied crucial evidence linking decedent's illness to Burnham's products. Next is ST versus 1727-29 LLC. On pages 14 and 15, it's another toxic torts case, this time lead paint, and it involves municipal law. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Moulton, held plaintiffs demonstrated defendants violated Local Law No. 1 of the City of New York in failing to take reasonable measures to address the hazardous lead-based paint condition in plaintiff's apartment. However, defendant's medical expert raised a question of fact whether defendant's negligence was the proximate cause of the plaintiff's child's injuries. The court wrote, under Local Law 1, defendant's liability is not predicated on their observations of peeling paint or whether they are informed of it. Defendant's liability does not depend on the mother demonstrating that she credibly complained about each and every instance or location of peeling paint. Even assuming that the mother never complained about the paint condition, defendants are charged with notice of the hazardous lead-based paint condition under Local Law 1 from the time that defendants were aware that ST moved into the apartment. Moreover, Local Law 1 imposes on landlords a specific duty to ameliorate hazardous levels of lead-based paint. Defendants cannot avoid liability by attempting to shift their statutory obligation to the mother by questioning her memory or credibility, or for failing to inform them when the paint began to peel. Shifting the burden to the mother is inconsistent with the purpose of Local Law No. 1, which is unquestionably intended to protect a definite class of persons, plaintiffs, from a particular hazard they are incapable of avoiding themselves. So again, although the defendants were found to be liable under Local Law 1 for the presence of lead paint, their expert raised a question of fact about whether the lead paint was the proximate cause of the child's injury. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this June 2020 negligence update CLE course. The verification code is LEAD. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this June 2020 negligence update CLE course is LEAD. Next is the O'Keefe case on pages 15 and 16, traffic accident case involving municipal law. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's expert raised a question of fact whether proper signage at the intersection where the traffic accident occurred could have prevented the collision. The fact that both drivers were familiar with the intersection did not require that the town's motion for summary judgment be granted. And that's what the Supreme Court held, and that was reversed. The court wrote, as a general rule, the question of proximate cause is to be decided by the finder of fact, but it may be decided as a matter of law, where only one conclusion may be drawn from the established facts. Here, in support of its motion for summary judgment, the town submitted evidence revealing that the drivers had some familiarity with the intersection, together with expert proof that the existing markings and traffic control devices were appropriate and consistent with applicable design standards. However, plaintiffs countered the town's showing with evidence that additional devices, such as a stop sign and painted stop bar, as well as pavement markings indicating the proper turning radius, were required for the subject intersection by applicable design standards. Plaintiff's expert opined that the absence of such markings and devices was a substantial contributing factor to the collision. Notably, a disagreement between experts merely creates a question of credibility to be resolved by the finder of fact. Upon review, we do not find the opinions expressed by plaintiff's expert in this matter to be lacking in either substance or foundation. Therefore, the town's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted. And turning to the final case, which is on page 16, Sucre versus Consolidated Edison. It's a utilities case. Plaintiff was electrocuted working on the roof of a home. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the complaint against the Con Edison defendants in this electrocution case should not have been dismissed for failure to state a cause of action. Plaintiff was working on a roof when he allegedly came into contact with an electric wire attached to the home and was killed. Con Edison argued it did not owe a duty to plaintiff's decedent. The court wrote, "The existence and scope of a duty is a question of law requiring courts to balance sometimes competing public policy considerations. Contrary to Con Edison's contention, it failed to establish that it owed no duty to the decedent. Viewing the allegations in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, since the plaintiff alleged that Con Edison authorized the installation of an improper and non-code compliant connection between its electrical lines and the homeowner's electrical system, such actions give rise to Con Edison's duty to the decedent, who reasonably could be expected to come into contact with the property's electrical wires. Thus, Con Edison did not establish that the plaintiff failed to state a cause of action to recover damages for negligence." And that completes this June 2020 Negligence Update CLE course.